Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV. This is the Reason TV talk show with my co-host Michael C. Moynihan, Reason editor-in-chief Matt Welch, author also of McCain, The Myth of a Maverick, being remaindered at bookstores around the country.
Yeah.
And Cato Institute Vice President David Bowes. Reason just celebrated its 40th anniversary with our December issue, 2008. Matt, the best thing in this is the article I co-wrote with you. we're talking largely about, or what we were going to talk about today is kind of 40 years of Reason and of libertarianism. Are we better off? Are we worse off? Michael, are you better off than you were 40 years ago?
I'm in my mid-40s now, and
yeah.
I feel better.
We
are obviously better off. And in that issue, there is a great article by Véronique Desrougies, making a convincing
Sounds
case.
Sounds aristocratic.
It is very aristocratic. She's, I believe she's from France.
Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, I obviously we are better off than we were 40 years
but
ago.
But why obviously? Because that article, as well as the Libertarian Moment story, cause some people are like, you're nuts.
Yes.
You're nuts if you think you're better off than you were 40 years ago. The government is bigger on every level. Right?
Michael said we're better off. And we're clearly richer. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, we're better off. We live better lives. Are we freer? I think that's a harder question. Mm-hmm. And I've been arguing that we are.
Mm-hmm.
But it's getting harder to argue. I don't know whether you noticed just this week, I believe, they announced they're going to use American troops in American cities, which has typically not been regarded as a good American thing to do. Plus, you've got the trillions of dollars of bailouts and so on.
Right.
So in a sense, I think maybe the libertarian moment was from the first Reagan tax cut until the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and you guys are like 10 years behind.
Okay. Yeah, I'll buy that. Why did it end with the Monica Lewinsky moment?
Well, it's not so much Monica Lewinsky, but I think you did have...
You really are obsessed with her, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I am. Okay. I have
just
a shrine.
Let it go.
I
mean,
Stephen Glass did an article on this.
Okay.
I have a shrine to Monica. I think what happened was, I mean, you know, obviously you had deregulation in the 70s, you had the tax cuts and Reagan's inspiring entrepreneurial rhetoric in the 80s.
And then, the blowout of government spending.
Well...
Yes. Did Reagan increase government spending?
Did Reagan increase government spending?
Did
yes,
government
it did.
Spending
was it
increase
slower
at the
than
states?
It was under Nixon and Ford and
sure.
Carter?
No.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah.
So, okay. So
but you're also adding, you know, the
yes,
second trillion is always the toughest, right?
I mean, right. But anyway, I think from the slash in tax cuts to a few reforms of the 94 Congress, which peter out by around 1998, and maybe it's because of the obsession with scandal, maybe it's just because 4 years is all Republicans can put together, but somewhere around then, there was even a possibility Clinton was looking at Social Security reform.
Right.
And all of that ended when he had to rally the Democratic troops. And then, of course, you get Bush.
Yeah.
And,
a disaster.
And Bush was a disaster.
I mean, on every level, George Bush has been a disaster.
Last night in a speech, I unveiled the term the Bush-Obama years.
Because
I think they're going to turn out to be pretty bad.
Yeah.
No, but isn't that whole focus that you just laid out, which is in many senses accurate, isn't it too government-focused? Doesn't it look for the conditions of our, you know, existence, our freedom, our liberty, whatever, as deriving from the government, as opposed to acknowledging the soup that we live in, which is actually not really, you know, something in which we are confronted with government.
Well, and this is just to back that up also. I mean, Hayek and Friedman at various points said if government grows, liberty recedes. They saw it as a zero sum.
Yeah, and I think in the way you posed the question, our conditions, our freedom, our liberty, aren't you blaming them on government? Not our conditions, and that's the point I made earlier with regard to Michael. Yeah, we're clearly richer.
And it's not just richer, it's freer. We have much more latitude to get out of our own communities.
Liberty.
To live in a way that expresses our own individual beliefs, if they are aberrant or considered to be aberrant 10 years ago,
and
40 years
and
ago.
And so in some ways we have more liberty. But Hayek and Friedman were right to say when government grows, liberty recedes. Government hasn't been growing in every way. We did have deregulation, and that was significant. We did have tax reductions, and we did also have a huge loosening of social strictures, much of which was the government, but some of which was not. And so in terms of, yes, feeling more free and open, and certainly one of the things I say to my straight white male libertarian friends who think we're less free.
Certainly, you know, there are no straight white males in the libertarian.
It's tougher to say that to blacks, gays, and women than it is to straight white men.
There are no blacks, gays, and women in the libertarian movement either. So.
Doesn't leave very many. So in a lot of ways, we have a more open society, and that's partly because government recedes and partly just because old social strictures.
Right.
But it's also not just technology. Right?
I mean, I'm a technological determinist, and I think in many ways, and Marx said something, you know, that the feudal system gave you, you know, hand planting or farming or
Richard
whatever.
Richard Marx, we're talking about?
Yeah, Richard Marx, the great Chicago poet and songwriter. No, but that the steam engine gave you capitalism, et cetera. And I think that a lot of it is technology, and that things like the inner tubes, a series of nets.
Yes,
I'm starting a whole new variation on this. But, you know, that it just allows for a decentralization and a personalization and an individualization of life, of liberty.
And I just think that's the majority of our existence, is that existence that takes place outside of, you know, who the hell runs Congress. I mean, on many levels, Americans don't care who runs Congress. They don't vote in large numbers. They take their cues of life, or they just enjoy themselves outside of the sphere of the tussle over government. And I think in that sphere, we are getting so much more free at an almost sort of orders of magnitude or an exponential type of way. And in that, I take great heart. And I also take great heart, excuse me, Michael, in that, I mean, if you compare right now, let's say, we're living in an awful sort of public policy moment. I think we can probably agree.
It can always get worse.
It can always get worse, but I mean, I think the bailout is, you know, in my history, when I, you know, rewrite 2008 all over again, it's certainly not going to be about the Obama election. It's all going to be about, you know, September, George Bush just staining his drawers that was a terrible image.
That was horrifying.
Yeah.
You remember the good old days when the bailout was $700 billion?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sure. Now it's $8.5 trillion. But, you know, all of that aside,
and I don't think Paulson's done yet.
Paulson's not done, but it's really unpopular. In 1971, when Richard Nixon unveiled wage and price controls, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was totally popular. And, you know, economists, except with a few exceptions, thought, oh, this is great. We need this. Obviously, this is the way to control inflation. I don't think we see that now. I think that there is a sense among the population at large, learned by, you know, another 20, 40 years of freedom of markets, of capitalism winning over communism, that basically free markets work better than the opposite. And I think that the bailout ultimately won't last or won't take hold, because I don't think Americans will reject it. And they'll reject it because they have learned the lessons of freedom better over the last 40 years than they did over the 40 previous.
Well, that would surely be true, because they sure didn't learn it very well in that previous 40 years. I hope you're right. I don't see as much anger about the bailout. And I do think people are just reeling. I mean, it was bailing out Bear Stearns, and then it was bailing out AIG, and then it was $700 billion, and now we're reading $8.5 trillion, and we have no idea what these numbers mean. So it's just beyond belief, and that's a problem. When you talk about the scope of freedom in our lives, though, I mean, the government takes half the money we earn. That's taking away a lot of freedom. We could do a lot with that kind of money.
Yeah. No, and there's
I don't think there's any question of that.
And I think there are also many ways
But it's also, I mean, was the take significantly smaller in 1968? You know, when you think of, like, the take of money or the overall control, I mean, you couldn't even shop on Sundays in 1968.
I guess that's true. I don't
know. No, I don't know.
I think it depended on, I think it probably depended on the place. But, yeah, sure, there were lots of things like that. Was the total take lower? The marginal rates were higher.
Right.
The total government take is probably about the same as a percentage. And, of course, because we are so much wealthier, because even with all these burdens, capitalism has produced so much more wealth.
Right.
It means we do have a lot more money available to us. And so I always say, junior Cato staffers fly off to Iceland for a rock concert. I couldn't have imagined doing that when I was 24 years old.
Oh, wait, Iceland still exists?
Yeah.
Well, this was last year.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The sugar cubes, though, have been bailed out.
They have been bailed out.
And we're going to take a break. We're back at the Reason TV talk show. I'm Nick Gillespie. My co-host is Michael C. Moynihan, not to be confused with Michael M. Moynihan, or the neo-Nazi writer and thrash metal, death metal.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. The even more Nazi. Michael Moynihan, not to be confused. Then there's Reason editor Matt Welch, the author of a book about John McCain.
How's that doing?
It must be picking up now.
Oh, yeah.
Interest is really
peaking. Printing every week. Yeah.
And Cato Institute stalwart, Vice President David Bowes, also author of several books, including my personal favorite is Libertarianism, a Primer, which I was just recommending in conversation to various people yesterday.
You have very boring conversations.
Yeah. Now tell me about it. And oddly, I was the only one in the room. I spend a lot of time, there's that old chimp thing where psychologists would paint a chimp to see if they could recognize themselves in a mirror. And it's not clear that primates totally understand when they're looking in a mirror if they see themselves or if they think it's another ape.
And what does this have to do with David Bowes?
Are the apes freer now?
Yeah, that's...
So we're going back to 1968 when Reason started, when the world started, for all intents
the world
and purposes.
Started, yeah.
But, and the planet
and the world
of the
was
apes,
in flames.
Were the planet of the apes, so is that more of a libertarian society than ours? I mean, it seemed very caste-oriented.
Yes.
And also, if you were an orangutan, you could only wear orange.
Yes. Right.
You know, it was... Yeah. Very stultifying.
Well, that was a 60s, 70s vision of what the future would
be
like.
Yeah, yeah.
All the movies about the future back then assumed that we would all wear single-colored jumpsuits in the future and that it would all be organized.
Yes.
But they were pretty nice-looking jumpsuits.
They were. I mean, I love the Dr. Zaius look with that ruffled thing.
My wife dresses up as a cast member of The Prisoner whenever possible.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So if we're in a libertarian moment, when are people going to start making the sci-fi movies about the libertarian future where we wear different clothes?
Well, I mean, sci-fi is all about anxiety about the future, right? Not about celebrations.
Well, it's about anxiety about the present.
Right, exactly.
Projected into
the future.
Do you watch Celebrity Rehab at all?
I do not.
On VH1, we were talking about it the other day. It's fantastic. And the best part is that Jeff Conaway, who played Kanicki in the movie version of Grease, and it was on Taxi, he's come back for a second season of Celebrity Rehab.
You don't want to get invited back twice.
It's bad to get picked up.
Yeah. Well, the original drummer from Guns N' Roses, Jeff Conaway, Gary Busey, Rodney King.
It's
like Paris. I mean, if you watch it long enough, you'll see everybody you've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, if that isn't an expression that we're much freer than
we
were.
I think so. Either that or we're already dying and we're drowning in a puddle on the side of the road, and this is our last thought.
Now, obviously marinating in the history of libertarianism, and you picked up a copy of Reason for the first time, like in 1972, 73. How did sort of libertarianism take hold, or how did you watch it take off, and what were like some of the big signs moments or when things just sort of exploded in your take?
Well, I suppose I got involved right after the Libertarian Party had been created, so that was certainly one of the things that was happening, and I did start...
Which was what, 71?
71,
yeah.
72,
yeah.
there was
right.
a convention, right? Yeah. And so I think the McBride campaign in 76 was significant.
And Roger Lee McBride, he was the second LP presidential candidate. He was the... adopted son and
adopted
a literary
grandson.
Executor of Rose Wilder Lane.
Right.
Yep.
Right. And so he had...
And he controlled, he controlled the Little House books,
yes,
right?
That's right. And he had made some money that way,
That's
right. And so he was a prosperous lawyer and had written a book. And so his campaign was important. Actually, though, Hayek's Nobel Prize in 1974, I remember being a big thing when I was at college, and then Friedman's Nobel Prize and Nozick's National Book Award. And all of that was like, wow, people are starting to notice these ideas. So I think that was significant. And then the 1980 Clark campaign, the high point of the Libertarian Party, but important because it brought a lot of people together.
And you were involved in the campaign,
right? And I was involved in that.
Why did Ed Clark do so well? Because one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, Reagan, a lot of libertarians, and you were even talking earlier, you know, Reagan did something for libertarianism, which is partly generational because it's clear he is extremely important in post-war American politics. But from my perspective, I'm not sure that he was really libertarian.
Oh, I wouldn't say he was really libertarian.
No, or even like minimized government. I mean,
there's something more important. I do believe
that Reagan and Thatcher together sort of revived the idea of limited government, of entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. They celebrated the idea of entrepreneurship and low taxes, even if they didn't make good on it as much as they could have. So in that sense, you know, I think we have been in a Thatcher-Reagan
paradigm. Did Ed Clark do so well, though? I mean, because he got 900,000 plus votes, I mean, which is more than double or about double even what Bob Barr got this time around.
Yeah. Right, and he got almost three times the percentage, over 1%. Well, there's a couple of things. For one thing, I mean, you know, he was a smart, pleasant guy, not a dynamic politician, but came across as intelligent and reasonable, unlike your typical third-party candidate that people expected. Mm-hmm. He had done well running for governor of California, so he had a little bit of credibility. Mm-hmm. He had at least semi-professional campaign staff, and he had a running mate who had a lot of money.
Right.
And so the
running mate, David Koch,
a member of Reason's board, I think.
That is correct,
and a member of the Cato Institute board.
Right.
And so... He
and by the way, one of the most attractive men I've ever seen. Really just a wonderful human being.
Yeah, he's a great,
a brilliant philanthropist, but in this particular case, he gave several million dollars, which allowed the Clark campaign to run something like 47 5-minute ads on national television. So I think the main reason he did well is he had money.
Yeah.
And no libertarian presidential candidate since has been able to get a billionaire running mate, which is what they need.
Yeah.
They try to balance their ticket, you know, with a woman or a person from another state or
somebody from the lower, the lowest income quintile.
Yeah, or, you know, a gambling an icon in the case of Wayne.
An infomercial specialist. Yeah. And what they need is somebody who can pay for the campaign because that's the only way you can do it. So that was important.
You know,
and after that, then you get an efflorescence of institutions happening, I think.
That's
Reason becoming a significant magazine from its college roots and the Cato Institute being founded and then all these other think tanks that are secretly libertarian but don't admit it.
Like who? Name one.
Yeah.
Brookings?
Brookings.
Sure.
Think tanks that are often run by libertarians but stick to economic issues.
Why do they do that? What is wrong with them?
Well, I wouldn't say there's anything wrong. Everybody makes their own strategic choice.
Right. Okay.
I think to a great extent it is assumed that you can unify more people around the free market than you can around a more all-encompassing...
Do you think that's true anymore? Because, I mean, clearly, sociologically, there was a huge overlap between conservatives and libertarians, and mostly centered around anti-communism and the idea that the free enterprise system was better or was the counterweight. But, I mean, do conservatives and libertarians match up the way that they used to? And what about this libertarian Democrat type stuff, which we've probably heard the end of since the Democrats are back in power.
Yes. Yeah.
But, I mean, are conservatives and libertarians, are they the cowboy and the rancher? Can they get along?
There are many problems with conservatives and libertarians.
That is a nod to a famous
Oklahoma
musical.
Oh.
A Broadway musical.
I read an article once about a diversity consultant in Nebraska, and I said, what does he do? Teach the cowboy and the rancher they can get along?
That's right.
I think it is still the case that an awful lot of people that we think of as libertarians, our friends, our supporters, think of themselves as Republicans, and they think conservative Republicans are better than moderate Republicans because they really believe in the Constitution and the free enterprise system, even if they don't actually act on it. So there is still that connection. And when we've all talked here in Washington a lot about this liberal-libertarian alliance, but the liberals don't seem interested.
No.
The conservatives are willing to tolerate libertarian deviations on war, civil liberties, and social tolerance, whereas it seems to me liberals...
Personal proclivities. That's the Bush administration coming for us right now. We're getting onto dangerous terms.
It seems to me liberals are not willing to tolerate our support for limited government and low taxes.
Is there a moment now with the great, much talked about conservative crack-up that libertarians can come in and help remake the Republican Party in any significant way? Do you see this as a possibility at all?
Well, I have mixed emotions about that. You'd have to become a Republican in order to try to remake...
To try to influence Republicanism.
But one of the problems is the more you're seen doing that, the more liberals figure you're a conservative. You're not one of us. So there is a strategic cost to doing that, but there's no question that a lot of libertarians are going to try to do it. What libertarians don't have is any political leadership. And I know you're going to get letters complaining that Ron Paul is a libertarian political leader, but I think within the Republican Party he is not perceived as a leader.
Well, it's not clear that he's a leader. Or even, and I like Ron Paul, and Matt and I co-wrote a couple pieces about him. I find the essence of his appeal very, very good and very strong, which is a message of decentralization and self-ownership and things like that. But it's not even clear he's libertarian. Based on the policy he espoused. I mean, if you're anti-immigrant, if you're anti-free trade agreement.
He's not really anti-free trade. Well, he's anti-free trade agreement, but he's not really anti-free trade.
No, but I mean, those are indistinguishable things in a world of politics. You know.
He ran at least one TV ad where he said, I'm the only candidate in either party who opposes the war and wants to cut federal spending.
Yeah.
That's a good libertarian.
Yeah, no, totally.
He finally ran that ad. That's
I understand he did. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Michael C. Moynihan, Matt Welch, and David Bowes. I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV.